This is a very unusual evening indeed for me. In fact, it's going to be the only evening of its kind in my entire lifetime because, as Jim has just said, this is the 500th anniversary this year of Mercator's birth. The exhibition next door is the only Mercator-related exhibition happening in the UK at all this year. And this is the only talk I'm giving on Mercator associated with the exhibition. So this is very much a one-off. And furthermore, Jim, bless him, has asked me to speak about something that I've never spoken about before. And he's really put me on the spot. Jim asked me, because of the nature of Between the Lines, to talk about why I came to write this biography of the man who I regard as the world's greatest cartographer. And I've never had to really think too much about it before, because I've been living with the man for so long. I've never really questioned, analysed, worked out exactly why I ended up devoting a sizable chunk of my life to somebody who died nearly 500 years ago. So this is going to be quite an exploratory conversation. Do feel free to interrupt whenever you feel like it. I'd much rather it was a conversation than me just talking all the time, and there will be time at the end. About an hour, Jim and all? Yeah. Yeah, so we'll have some questions at the end. Not sure I'll be able to answer them. But in the meantime, I will endeavour to explain how I came to write this biography. I'm a book writer, that's what I do. I've always written books. I'm not sure how many I've written, 10 or 12 maybe. And I've always worked in storytelling, I suppose you could say, all non-fiction. So I've made documentaries for the BBC, radio documentaries and TV documentaries, and I've written for the newspapers, magazines, but mainly I write books, that's what I do. And books have to be big, resilient stories to justify all the time and expense that a publisher has to go to wrap them up between two covers and try and sell them. So you only embark upon a book if you know it's going to run the distance. I began as a 19-year-old looking for stories, inspired initially by travel. When a year out of school, I was leafing through my atlas, the one that was geography undergraduates we were told we had to buy. This is the page from it here. Thanks, Jim. And I was looking for a journey. I initially, when I was a youngster, I had no money. I don't have much now, actually. And so travel had to be very, very low budget, either walking or on my school bicycle. I was very interested in the time, in fact, right away from probably 8-10 years old in maps and in navigation. My father once dropped me off in the middle of Dartmoor with my cousin. I think we were about 14 at the time, with two Ordnance Survey maps, 2 days' worth of food and a tent, and he gave us a six-figure grid reference and told us that we should be there in 2 days' time. It was thick mist, and that was where I learned about dead reckoning, a very essential method of navigation. And there we go. And that was the moment when I was 14 when I realised that maps were so accurate, British Ordnance Survey maps, that you could navigate within about 10 metres even after 2 days of continual travel in a whiteout. The reason those maps are so accurate is very much to do with the man I'm talking about this evening, Mercator. Once I started making my own journeys, this is one I was talking about a bit earlier on when I was 19, I kind of labelled them place name journeys. They were journeys to places that evoked something compelling. There were places on maps. The very first one I went on as a big journey was to this peninsula here, the southern tip of mainland Greece, Cape Matapan. It's the most southern point, on the mainland of Greece, not the most southern point in Europe. That's over here in southern Spain, but this is I suppose you could call it the bottom right-hand corner of mainland Europe, the most southeastern corner. As a pole of evocation, as I tend to think of these place name destinations, it was particularly interesting because this, back in the days of Pausanias, the Roman travel writer, was the entrance to Hades, the entrance to hell. And there's a cave there described in great detail by Pausanias, and I knew about this cave, and I thought, well, it would be great fun to get on my school bike up in Norwich, up in East Anglia, and try and pedal to the gates of hell. But I was 19, didn't have any money, and with my best friend, a Scotsman, who was very good at living on absolutely nothing, we set off with two borrowed sleeping bags from the mountaineering club, a sheet of polythene each from a hardware store, and 3 weeks later, we arrived in Greece, and then had 6 weeks exploring, following Pausanias, using a 2,000-year-old guidebook to explore southern Greece. The year afterwards, the same terms we thought we'd go off to Marrakesh here, the same method on bicycles. Again, it was another place name destination, a different type of pole of evocation. I mean, this was very much inspired by, and Marrakesh back then was, I'm talking a very long time ago here, it was the San Francisco, Kabul, Kathmandu, you know, it was part of that quartet. Do you remember that song, Marrakesh Express, Crosby, Stills and Young? Well, that was 1969, I think, wasn't it? Or something around there. So all the long hairs, all the students wanted to go to Marrakesh about that time. But most of them were going the easy way, and I thought we'd pedal there. So that was another pole of evocation, destination. We just pedal all the way across France and the Pyrenees and Spain. And we didn't get to Marrakesh because we both went down an extreme dysentery with broken bicycles with about 100 miles to go, and we ran out of money as well. So it's very frustrating that to get so close. And we got to Fez in North Africa. I only mention these stories because they're all leading, they all build up towards this biography, really. Sometime after that, really quite a long time after that, still on. Let's see, let me change this picture. Master my iPad. Here we go. Same atlas, my university atlas. One of the things I've always been very curious about, and this again has a Mercator connection, is looking for things that nobody else has done. Believe it or not, there was a place in the world back in the 1980s that nobody, a very significant place in the world, a place in the world most distant from the open sea, and nobody knew where it was. This place is obviously in the centre of Asia, the largest landmass. Right in the middle of this landmass, on my atlas, there's a place that's most distant from the open sea. You need a huge lump of algebra, which I'm sure Jim would find very straightforward, measuring great circle distances, to work out where it is. Fortunately, my cousin was doing a PhD in geology, PhD at the time, and a very good mathematician, so he worked out the maths. And it turned out to be latitude 46 degrees, 16.8 minutes north, longitude 86 degrees, 40.2 minutes east, and precisely 2,648 kilometres in a straight line from the three points of sea closest to the centre. You sort of triangulate it. So that was one of the points. And then Bohai Wong, Sea of China there, and Oskar Guba up in the on the Arctic coast of Siberia. So this central point in Asia is equidistant from the three inlets reaching furthest in towards the centre of the continent. The actual spot, if I can reach it, is in the Taklamakan Desert, not well known as a bicycling destination, about there. The Taklamakan, you may know, as you've read Mildred French, Mildred Cable and Francesca French, two great women travellers of the 19th century, who crossed it on their camels. Hottest desert in the world, and that's the centre of the Earth, as we call it there, the point most distant from the open sea. 2,500 kilometres in a straight line, with about 5,500 to ride by bicycle. Of course, you've got a few options, you've got three options to go there. So this is the 80s, and one option was ruled out because it meant crossing the border between the Soviet Union, what was the Soviet Union, and China up there. So coming from Skye Goob in the north, tricky because it's illegal border crossing. Coming from the east, from Bohai Wong, a bit dull, China all the way. Coming from the south, very interesting. Bay of Bengal, Bangladesh, up the Ganges, through the corner of India,
through Nepal, from south to north, Kathmandu, over Himalayas, interesting that ride.
And then the first ever,
as far as you make out, crossing Tibet, the Tibetan Plateau, at its widest point, going north, over the Kunlunshan, quite an incredible range of mountains.
Nobody, as far as I know, has yet walked the length of Kunlunshan. Don't do a variety of these.
But they're very long, nearly as long as Himalayas. So over those, and then across the Katmandu.
Interesting bike ride, and it took quite a while. We did this on very lightweight bicycles so that we could keep momentum up, and also because we had to wait till the snows melted on the Himalayas before we could cross the Himalayas, and then we had to cross the Tibetan Plateau at very high speed because the Gobi Desert was warming up rapidly. So the whole thing was based around effectively a bike race from here to there. And we took no food. We bought food off Tibetan nomads and we asked passing lorry drivers for water. So it was a very lightweight trip indeed. No tent or anything like that, and just slept outside. Fascinating trip, and if anyone goes back, they will find a Chinese monument in the wrong place. The Chinese got quite interested in the centre of the earth after being there. But the real location, you'll find a cache of buried documents. I can get a little hand-drawn map if you want to go back and do that. So that was the centre of the earth. That was a very abstract, probably the most abstract destination I've ever devoted a large amount of time to reaching. Just a grid reference. By the way, there's nothing there, of course, just desert and camel dung. Not a lot to look at. How do I do this? Okay. Now, back to Europe again. Here we go. I became quite interested in journeys that were related to lines on maps. Now, again, something nobody had thought of doing before, but perfectly obvious if you like looking at maps. Again, back to my old view of the Atlas, the European page. Are you all familiar with looking at North America and that great rocky, the great spine of the Rocky Mountains running down North America? Very obvious linear topographical route, being walked, cycled, probably being horse ridden, everybody's been down it. But we've got a kind of much more interesting one in Europe, going laterally from west to east, east to west, starting here in the Sierras of northern Spain, then running through the Pyrenees, up through the Cevennes, Alps end to end. Up here through the Carpathians, Transylvanian Alps, Balkan Mountains, out to Istanbul. And a very obvious mountain watershed, at least it was to me when I saw it. And culturally very interesting, because exactly half of it lay west of here, in what we used to call Western Europe there, and exactly the other half, another 5,000 odd kilometres, much more wiggly route in Eastern Europe, what we used to call Eastern Europe there. So a very interesting symmetrical route. Of course, it also divides north and south, northern temperate Europe north of that mountain watershed, and southern Mediterranean Europe below it, on the south side of it. A topographical line to follow. On this occasion, I thought I'd walk it, because I was quite interested in writing about mountain cultures, and that led to this book here called Clear Waters Rising. That was a journey, really, threading together Europe's shrinking mountain cultures. In the East, particularly interesting, because there you have shepherds still practicing transhumance, going up into the mountains in spring, living with their flocks through the summer, then going back down again in the autumn. And those are the people I bought cheese from, milk from, and in whose cabins I stayed, slept when I was in the eastern part of the journey. So that was another linear route. Now, back to another very, very abstract one. You'll know, I'm sure, of the landscape artist Richard Long. I've been following Richard's work for quite some time. He'd been exhibiting a lot through the 80s and 90s. And I was very, very moved by some of his linear works, his straight line works on landscapes. And having made a long, wiggly, highly subjective walk across Europe, and my mountain walk across Europe, by definition, I was only going to be mixing with mountain cultures. So I was only going to be writing about mountain cultures. I thought, well, what happens if you follow an absolutely dead straight line, create a linear transect, through a land and limit yourself to only writing about the people and places on that transect. It should be, you know, it'd be an experimental travel book because it's completely objective, of course. It's a random sample from a straight line. And it would be as true a reflection as you could possibly get of a place, of this place called England. So I then had to try and devise a straight line. This was incredibly difficult because it had to be a straight line with some meaning. And it took a very long time to come up with this. And I was very lucky. I just happened to have a history of the Ordnance Survey kicking around on the floor of my study one day. And I was leafing through it with nothing else to do. And was reading about the history of the various projections that the OS had experimented with in the early years. And they'd eventually settled on the transverse Mercator projection. So you'll see on the bottom of this OS map, little label saying it's mapped on the Mercator projection, and indeed on this Admiralty chart here, this is also mapped on the Mercator projection. Now, one of the characteristics of the transverse Mercator projection is that you need a central meridian. You need a central line, rather like the spine of a book, from which you will make all of your measurements. And the line they chose for the Ordnance Survey chose in Britain was not the Greenwich Meridian, which of course is over on the east side, over on the east here. So if they'd chosen the Greenwich Meridian, it would have progressively distorted the mapping the further west you went. It had to be a much more central line. So the central meridian of Britain, used by the Ordnance Survey, is actually 2 degrees west, which runs from, very convenient from my point of view, the point at which the Scottish and English border meets, that is pure coincidence, up in the top there, like a plumb line right down to the middle of England and Wales, and it goes into the sea on the Isle of Purbeck in Dorset. The great merit of following this line is that it is the only line of longitude marked on Ordnance Survey maps, because of course all the other lines slightly curve in both ways. So they're not marked on the OS, but 2 degrees west is, because it's the central one, you can actually follow it. It's marked on both 150,000 and 125,000 maps. And so that line on this map, I've actually drawn to scale. It's from the book I wrote, and I've actually used a thickness of nib to draw that line that matches the width of the route I followed. So what was possible using OS maps, 125,000 maps, was to walk the length of England, never straying more than 1,000 metres from that line of longitude. So I slept, ate, bought my food and everything within that 2,000 metre wide sort of glass corridor, which is the width of this black line here. So it's a pretty good straight line. Very interesting project. It was genuinely a cross-section. It was an unbelievably difficult book to write. This is it here. It's out of print for obvious reasons. One of the difficulties with it is, of course, with an objective travel book, you're breaking a fundamental rule of travel writing, which is you're totally destroying the story before you've started. Because, of course, all the important points, you know, you don't get a crux, you don't get a crisis happening 7/8 of the way through your journey that's been engineered because you've deliberately chosen to hang glide over the Himalayas in penultimate chapter. All you know, the high points and low points happen all the wrong moments. And furthermore, that line perversely avoids all the things you'd normally try and write about in travel book. It misses the best bit of Hadrian's Wall. It goes through an awful lot of suburbs. It goes right through the middle of the Longbridge car plant. So I had to get permission to go through one of the assembly plants on the night shift with my rucksack and umbrella, much to the amusement of the workers. And I had to wade various rivers and canals, a bit of swimming. The RAF had to escort me across the main runway of RAF Lynham while Hercules planes were taking up. And the army escorted me across the live firing ranges on Salisbury Plain in a column of 8 of us, one behind the other, on a rigidly adhered to compass bearing led by an officer. They thought they were highly amused by the whole thing. Finally, the very end, this is really off the call, off subject now, but the very end bit here is a large body of water, Poole Harbour, one of the biggest harbours and natural harbours in the world. And because the the RAF had been very cooperative and then the Army had been very cooperative, I thought, well, let's see if the Navy want to help out with Pearl Harbor. And they did. They got me over across Pearl Harbor on a rigid radar boat. So a huge amount of fun, but a tricky book to write, and with mixed reviews. The Daily Mail said that I was a prat. The Daily Telegraph said that I was a genius. Mind you, at the time, I was writing for the Daily Telegraph. So, now, which brings me on to the man, Mercator, because by the time I'd subjected myself to 2 months of straight lining and writing a book was much more arduous than the walking, I'd been thinking about the man who had devised the projection that created this straight line for really quite some time. And of course, we've all heard of Mercator's projection. And when I was writing that book, I thought, well, I want to put a passage in the book about this map maker, this man who had devised the projection that's used by Ordnance Survey, by Admiralty charts for all of our offshore sailing and navigation and so on. But so I go down to the British Library, and there's no biography. So that's rather curious, it's a big Renaissance figure, any number of biographies on all the major Renaissance figures, but not a single one on Mercator. And the more I thought about it, the more I became intrigued. And of course, the thing is with books that you get drawn in, and once, it's rather like big journeys, once you've had the idea, it's much less trouble to go ahead and respond to it than to live with never having had the nerve to for the rest of your life. And it's very tricky because sometimes these challenges can be very daunting. My experience is that the more frightening a challenge, the more worthwhile the project, and whether it's a journey or a book. And so I started thinking about writing a book about Mercator, because there wasn't one. And one of the things that excited me, probably the thing that excited me most, because I've always been very drawn by projects that nobody's tried to do before, was the fact that there wasn't an English language biography. There's quite a good German one that had been written 100 years ago, a very short one, by two Germans, Abba Duncan Muller, but there was no, aside from a chapter in a wonderful modern American, very scholarly work on 16th century map makers by a man called Robert Caro, there was no reliable source of information, really, on Mercator's life, certainly no biography. But I have a geography degree. I'm not a historian. I'm not very bright. I made a profession of failing most of my exams, and I like telling stories and writing books. And writing a biography of a Renaissance mapmaker, and in particular a scientific one, was very, very daunting. Mercator travels with a lot of labels. I said the Ordnance Survey used him to map Britain. The Admiralty, British Admiralty, used him for his charts. NASA had used his projection for mapping Venus, Jupiter, and Titan and solar system. Back in his own age, Mercator was referred to by one of his fellow mapmakers as the Prince of Modern Geographers. His great friend and his rival, Abraham Ortelius, called him the Ptolemy of our age. The modern historian Daniel Boorstin, the author of that wonderful book, The Discoverers, regarded Mercator as the figure who transformed the world of maps for the new secular age. And this man, Robert Caro, who wrote this wonderful book on 16th century mapmakers, an absolutely must-have tome if you're interested in maps, crowned Mercator the first modern scientific cartographer, which is the label that really, really, really inspired me. And Caro's book is quite an extraordinary work of scholarship. And I thought, well, writing a first biography of the first modern scientific cartographer can only be a very, very exciting project indeed. And as a writer of non-fiction, you can wait your whole lifetime to come across a subject like this, an unwritten biography of a great Renaissance figure. So it had to be done. But it was very, very daunting. It was a formidable challenge. What I'd be trying to do was to reconstruct the life of a man who died nearly just over 400 years ago, and bring him back to life in such a way that the context of his age and of his own personal circumstances would help inform his work, this passage that he took to be towards being the first scientific cartographer. I'll say a couple of words about the man because his own personal circumstances were one of the reasons that I found him a very addictive character to live with. He was a very humble man, both in background and temperament. He was infuriatingly modest. People who are crowned, you know, the Ptolemy of our age nowadays are probably going to put it on Twitter and Facebook and shout it from the rooftops. Mackayton never blew his own trumpet. He was a hopeless self-publicist. He didn't write books or treaties or papers celebrating his own achievements. And not only that, but a lifetime of on and off persecution meant that he covered his tracks incredibly well. Only 45 or so of his letters have survived, which is nothing from a lifetime over 80 years. The most important source, of course, were his maps, and there's about 100 of those printed maps that have survived in his famous atlas, which I'll talk about in a moment. I don't think there's a best method of tackling a biography. Are there any biographers here tonight? I hope not. I could probably have done with meeting a biographer and chatting it through beforehand. I think the prerequisite is an all-consuming obsession with your subject and with his or her world. I mean, it is a kind of love. When you write a travel book, you have to take this journey, often a challenging journey, and you have to do that first. You've got to undertake that first before you can do any writing. Ideally, to my mind, these journeys are solitary ones, and journeys that require complete immersion, both in the places and people that you're going to be meeting, going through, and ones you're going to be writing about. I think with biographies, the journey is very much a psychological one. It's in your own head, but it's still a journey, and it's just a solitary with the same partings of ways, partings of tracks, decisions to be made, and the same false summits. I imagine I'm not the only biographer who's had crises writing a biography. There are times when I thought I'd really bitten off far more than I could chew, and I really wondered whether I was going to manage it. I think what I started. Jim's asked me to explain how I went about doing it. I started doing a kind of 3-month reconnaissance in the British Library, also the Royal Geographical Society, the National Library of Scotland. So, copyright libraries, the RGS. Those are where I started looking at maps, looking at papers, a lot of academic papers. I hope you'll come back and look at the exhibition next door. But a lot of the instruments on show next door have papers written about them, and each of those papers, even if it's about something apparently not directly related to your subject matter, case, it might be on asteroids, it might be on globes, they open a window of insight. Having spent 3 months in libraries, I was in a bit of a state knowing where to start, and then I had a brainwave. I thought I'll go to the village that he was born in. It'll break this sort of, it'll get me going. So I went over to the Low Countries and visited two villages, one called Ruppelmond. I think I've got a picture of it here, or a map showing where it is. Let's see. Yeah. Here we go. So over to the Low Countries.
So this is the area, rough area, where Mercator was born and growing up. Antwerp's here. So he pretty much didn't leave this map in his entire lifetime, which is extraordinary. He spent the first part of his life here in Ruppelmond, and then the second part over on the Rhine on the right-hand side of this map here.
And it is extraordinary because if you look at some of his contemporaries, like Albrecht Dürer, for example, crisscrossing, great artist, crisscrossing Europe, 1520-odd, do a travel from Nuremberg to Frankfurt to meet the landscape painter Joachim Patinir. And Erasmus, continually travelling to and fro across the continent, writing diaries which have survived. Mercator barely left this map for the full 84 years of his life. So I went to Rupelmonde and to... now, this is one of Mercator's own maps. Very interestingly, this is the map which, effectively, it's a biographical map, I think. I'm afraid the details not enough to read anything, it doesn't really matter. It's just a mass of place names and geographical detail. It's the only map in his atlas of over 100 maps with no title. Very mysterious. There was a reason with Mercator for doing everything. The other 106 maps all had titles. This one's the only one that doesn't. And this is the map of his life. This is the map. I don't think he ever left this map. So Antwerp on the Scheldt left here, Duisburg in the Rhine over on the right here. Entire lifetime spent on this one map. I've got another clear image of this here. Here we go. So here's a close-up, and you can see Rupelmonde here. This is the village you grew up in. Antwerp's just up there. This is the River Scheldt going out to the North Sea. Rupelmonde's where he grew up as a small boy, and the ruined castle that he was eventually imprisoned in is still there. It's locked up by the Inquisition. I spent 2 or 3 days walking the streets of the village. I managed to get an 18th century engraving of the village, the closest image we have to the place that Mercator would have known as a child. We also have this rather fascinating painting here from Bruegel. It's called The Games. This is just a detail from it, but. His famous painting showing all the kinds of games. Bruegel was a contemporary of Mercator, all the kind of games that kids in the Low Countries played. You can see there's a river in the background there, there's a boy climbing a tree. You've got two girls apparently jousting, and then three girls spinning their skirts out like spinning tops. And I imagine then there's a child swimming in a little stream there. And I imagine this was the kind of childhood Mercator has. I mean, it would have been an ordinary childhood, but... He had a tough time. His father was a cobbler. He was orphaned when he was quite young and brought up by his uncle. So a very poor background. Went to Leuven University, some fantastic instruments next door from Leuven, produced at the same time that Mercator was there. And he fell in with some of the greatest minds of the age. Gangelt. Actually, I should go back to Gangelt, see if I can find Gangelt, which is over on the right-hand side of this map here, which I won't be able to find because it's far too small, but it's a little village called Gangelt on the right-hand side in northern Germany. And that was where he's actually born, and then after living in Rupelmonde, being persecuted by the Inquisition, he moved back to Germany, to Duisburg, which is where he did his greatest work, to my mind. Now, going back to how I was raised, so I went over to Low Countries, and it did make all the difference. There's no question that if you've done quite a lot of research already, you've got the context of times, early 1500s, so we're talking about plague, war, climate change. The Little Ice Age is starting. Bruegel's painting Four Seasons with that winter scene with everybody... skating and the landscape completely frozen solid. Thames froze at the same time. This was a very frightening time indeed. A lot of people, including Mercator, thought the world was going to end. So it was an apocalyptic time. A lot of wars as well. Mercator was tangled up in at least one war. So very, very difficult, time. And once you got that context, and I remember walking through the muddy fields outside Gangelt, the German town was born in. I got mud all over my boots. The walls of the town, the gateway, are still there. And it all comes flooding back. And so when I came back to London, I felt that I'd made contact, really, with the young Mercator. I went to Leuven too, and of course it's still a famous university. And although, tragically, the town got absolutely smashed to pieces in the First World War, there's enough of it left for you to get a few little vignettes, a few little memories linger of what it must have been like in the early 1500s, when Mercator, 1530s, when Mercator was there. So back in London, I piled into it in the British Library. In fact, I spent nearly 3 years in the British Library. I did tot up because I was curious. I think I probably spent about 7,000 hours researching the book overall. Say most in the British Library. What happens, very interesting, coming at a book like this from the outside, I felt very nervous and anxious and for at least a year quite out of my depth. We can all read, and a lot of academic papers need a dictionary and an encyclopedia to help you wade your way through them initially. But after about a year, actually a bit less than that, after about 6 months of sitting in the British Library, Peter Barber, a very famous map historian who's also the map librarian at the British Library, had been seeing me in there every day. He eventually came over and, as Peter does, became a wonderful friend and help. He asked me what I was doing. And as soon as I explained, everything changed, because it hadn't really occurred to me that I wasn't an imposter, that I wasn't trespassing. I'd seen quite well-known historians coming in and out of the British Library map room, busy writing their books and their academic papers and so on. Never dared speak to any of them. And once Peter had broken the ice, everything changed, and I became the recipient of an unbelievable amount of scholarly generosity. And it turned my solitary journey into something altogether very different. And I'm thinking particularly of Peter, who would share his knowledge in a way that I found completely surprising. I mean, he would bound over sometimes like a small boy, having just discovered some new burly marginalia in an obscure atlas. Catherine Delano Smith, another great British map historian, was writing a paper at the time for the History of Cartography on map symbols. So we'd have long coffee breaks, talking about what Mercator might have been up to, some of the map symbols. And it's absolutely fast. Tony Campbell, another map historian who was working in that time. All incredibly generous. I also started going to Warburg map. Anyone been to Warburg map lectures? I mean, yeah, they're fantastic, aren't they, Steve? And still going on. The Warburg map lectures in Bloomsbury are just an unparalleled source of ideas, information. People from all over the world come to these regular map lectures in North London. And again, the people are very, very kind and interested there, particularly the historians coming from the Low Countries. I also started going along to the London Map Fair. Nowadays it's only held once a year in the Royal Geographical Society, but back then there was a London Map Fair every 4 weeks in the Bonington Hotel. So I started going along there too, and that produced something rather unexpected. The London Map Fair is frequented by international map dealers who, it's rather like a car boot sale for priceless maps. They set up trestle tables in the hotel and bring over thousands of maps from all over the world and flog them to each other once a month. At least they used to, it doesn't happen anymore. But they are, of course, all experts, these map dealers, and they have had through their hands thousands of maps, a great proportion of them 16th century maps. And as it happened, of course, they're all obviously very familiar with Mercator's maps. So I went there every month, again, for the best part of 2 or 3 years, and got to know the dealers, and they were also very generous. And what they taught me was something that I would have had difficulty picking up in libraries and archives, which was the quite kind of, on the face of it, nerdy world of Renaissance printing, and the kinds of telltale signs that you can look for when you're trying to identify different states of a map. The maps that Mercator was specializing in were all copperplate maps. This was state-of-the-art printing. Copperplates came in on the back of woodblock printing. Woodblock printing was very clunky, clumsy, impossible to letter, put labels on your maps neatly with woodblocks, because you simply couldn't chisel the boxwood, the hardwood, carefully enough. Copperplate printing comes along, And if you look at that incredible globe next door, you'll see that some of the lettering on that globe is only 3 millimetres high, written with a steel spike point on a polished copper plate in mirror writing by Makeda. So you could get, you can see this map here, this is all scratched into the surface of a copper plate with a steel point. Now these maps here, this is actually a second state map. I'm afraid my photograph is too rubbish to show you why, but you have to imagine that the bottom third of this map has all been, it's called hammered out. Makeda produced the first draft of it on the copper plate. It was printed, it was published. You can probably, I guess, 1,000 pulls off a copper plate, Jim? About 1,000, yeah. But at some point, and I think it was probably, there seems to be the suggestion that Makeda himself did the revision, because there's evidence of a journey he made along the southern part of the map. He realised that his rivers and towns on the southern part of this map were in the wrong place, so he turned the copper plate upside down, hammered it from behind, polished all the geography off, returned it to a flat plate, and then re-engraved all the new geography, the latest information, data, geographic data, onto the copper plate. And the only reason you know that is that one of these dealers happened to have this particular map, and he said, come and look at this, Nick. And if you held a magnifying glass up on the bottom of this map, you could see a faint image all the way across the bottom here of another map. It's rather like one painting on top of another. So you could see how far he'd moved all the towns, the villages and the rivers before he updated it, because the ink was just, he hadn't quite polished the old geography off enough. Maybe just didn't want to make the copper plate too thin. So that's called a second state map, and those sorts of little details start to become very, very important when you're writing a book about a mapmaker, because it tells you something about, in this case, Makeda's passion for detail and accuracy. That, you know, a map was not a static, temporally fixed product that you just bunged out onto the market. It was a bit like a modern bit of software that could be updated absolutely continuously. I've got another picture I'll show in a moment. I'm going to stop in a moment, actually, that'll illustrate that. So the map dealers were also a huge part of the research project. What I ended up with was I had to go and buy a bigger table at home, actually, to sort this out. I ended up with a table not much smaller than this one here. And after about 3 years, I had all this material, which I then organised. Actually, it evolved. It was being organised from the start I guess you could call them phases of his life. So there were probably about 20 piles initially, from birth through till death, and then kind of his legacy. Each one of his pile, and in those piles were hundreds and hundreds of sheets of yellow A4 notes, because you can't take books out of the British Library. And a lot of the sources I was using in the BL were in the manuscript section, some of the books next door here. Priceless books that you have to read with white gloves and use a pencil and take notes. So hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of pages of these yellow sheets of A4, all organised in piles, with off-prints from various learned journals on the same piles if they overlapped with that particular phase. And then with my own books and maps and so on. So all these piles. And those piles evolved into the chapters of the book. I'm not sure how many chapters there are in the end, but it changed so often. But there are a lot of chapters in this book, I'm guessing. But I reckon I started with... I started with about 20 piles, and I've ended up with 31 chapters. And that, of course, is because the further into the story you get, the more you feel the need to separate episodes or insights that overlap or become confusing because they've been juxtaposed, to pull them apart and create new separate chapters for them. So I think I'm going to leave it there, because I'd love to sort of have more of a chat about to find out what you might like to ask me. I think I'll just round up perhaps by summarising, to my mind, what his main achievements were, because otherwise it wouldn't be about my own writing. But so in a nutshell, some of these things I haven't talked about. I'd like to mention first the globe next door. In fact, there are one, two, three globes next door, I think. Three globes next door. Two of them. This is in the Mercator exhibition. Two of them are by Mercator, the 1541 terrestrial globe and the 1551 celestial globe. There's also a globe by Schirner of Nuremberg, which is, in fact, you could argue that three globes next door are the three most important globes of the entire 16th century, right here in central Oxford. But the 1541 terrestrial globe has a particular resonance for me. This is the first tonight. It's the first time I've seen it for about 8 years. That globe is kept under wraps in a warehouse at the National Maritime Museum. It is so precious that it barely sees the light of day. It's fantastic that it's here. Before I first saw it, I'd have to apply to see it. And make a journey to Greenwich just to be allowed to sit with it for several hours. I read everything there was to read about it beforehand, all Elie Decker's papers, the lot, all the contextual material. I had read everything you could possibly read about both that particular globe and its context. And when the archivist, the NMM, carried it out and put it in front of me, I was completely speechless. I was almost in tears, actually, because I'd spent so long thinking about this globe. What I wasn't prepared for was its beauty and its detail. Because all I'd seen were close-up photographs taken by various academics and drawings. I had no idea that he had compressed so much information onto this globe. It was rather like looking inside a computer chip. It's completely plastered in place names, written in minute hand engraved lettering, and furthermore the it's a combination of several things: the detailing on it, the exquisite quality of the lettering, and the organisation of the coasts and geographical features and lettering. The fact that it's also got celestial information on it as well, which actually makes it more, if anything, it's a cosmographical globe as well. It's actually doing two jobs at once. And it's also built into the most extraordinary bit of globe furniture, which at the time was groundbreaking. Globes tended to be perched on rather wobbly tripods, stands. Mercator wanted his globes to be practical scientific tools, so he created this very robust four-legged timber frame that this fragile globe sits in. And when I was getting his letters translated from Latin, I discovered that one of the reasons he built these very strong frames is that these globes have been packaged up and put in barrels and shipped on horseback and boat from Duisburg all over Europe. These were tools to be used. They weren't just for looking at. These were tools. So his globe next door is probably one of the most important things he did. In fact, it definitely is. He produced the first manual of Italic handwriting to be published north of the Alps. So he's a brilliant calligrapher. He was an instrument maker. If you go and look next door at some of the instruments, you'll see the kinds of instruments he would have been making at the time. He was the first to label on a printed map a continent we now call North America. This was at a time when the world was being discovered, of course. I'm just going to show you a couple of pictures here. Here's a sea monster. This is one of Mercator's sea monsters, but actually this is unusual. At the time, maps were conventionally covered in sea monsters and ships like this one here, lots of decoration. Mercator broke this tradition. He wanted maps to be seen as mathematical representations of God's creation. So his maps were much less decorative, and they all carried grids of latitude and longitude around the edges. He produced well over 100 maps in his lifetime, so pretty productive. He lived two lifetimes, really. He lived to the age of 84, and was working right to the end, at a time when many people are dead in their 40s. He produced, and this is his greatest achievement. I talked about the projection used by NASA, used by the Ordnance Survey, used by the Admiralty now, talked about his globe, most important globe of the 16th century. But to my mind, his most important achievement was producing this book here, an atlas. This is an atlas I wrote, but this is a conventional little uni atlas. Mercator was the first person to use the term atlas to describe a bound volume of maps, and this, to my mind, was his greatest work. What he was trying to do was to convert the three-dimensional globe into a two-dimensional book of flat maps without losing mathematical veracity, clinging to that mathematical truth. That's the reason he produced this unique projection, which doesn't distort compass bearings when you take your compass from the 3D globe to 2D map. His atlas was unique for various reasons. Let's see if I can find a page. Here's a page. Here's Northern Scotland from the atlas. Unique in two or three respects. He believed that atlas maps should overlap so that, for example, the Northern Scotland sheet would overlap with the next sheet south. And the reason for that was that twofold. It allowed you to travel seamlessly around the world on sheets that fitted together. Now, at the time, all the other books of maps, we can call them atlases, although Mercator's was truly the only atlas because he was the first one to use the term, those other books of maps were compiled by editors from various cartographers. So you could have 5, 10 different cartographers all supplying maps to go in one atlas. And of course, none of the maps fitted together. They looked lovely, they didn't fit together. Mercator believed all the maps should fit together. He also believed that there should be a range of scales, and this is where I'm going to finish, because this is a simple little illustration of why he deserved to be remembered. I'm going to take you through four scales of map in his atlas. This is the world map in his atlas. So here you've got the entire world on two hemispheres. You can look at his atlas and you can see, yep, this is where all the continents are. It's not Mercator's projection, which distorts geography wildly. Very curious Arctic up there with four concentric islands. Simply enormous Antarctica, not probably discovered yet. Straits of Magellan exist. 1522, Magellan goes through there. North America is taking shape. It's pretty much the world as we know it today. The biggest error is the Arctic, which I won't go into now, a deeply fascinating subject. So that's the first scale. You can zoom in the atlas, and you get a second scale. Here we are looking at the whole British Isles, England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland. And you can zoom in once more, so there you've got a whole landmass or archipelago. You can zoom in once more, and you get the whole of England on a single page, with the counties all marked. You can zoom in one more time. I hope. Okay. Here we go. That's blurry, I'm afraid, but you'll get the idea. This is the southeast of England. We've zoomed in one more time, so a whole sheet showing the southeast of England. London's on there somewhere, and Oxford. Now, if you zoom in one more time, if you get your magnifying glass out, you can find Oxford right in the middle here. Just there. So, what we've got here, we've got four different scales. And you can zoom in, just as you can on Google Earth now, from the entire planet to Oxford. Now, this is the first time you've ever been able to do it in a book called an Atlas. Not affordable, of course, it's a very expensive book, but there are a lot of them printed, and they were in all the courts and libraries, important courts and libraries in Europe. So that, in a nutshell, is why I devoted so much time to writing that book. I think if I just leave you one quote, because this is totally vainglorious and inappropriate, but I'm going to do it because I can, because I'm a and I'm very proud, because I say the Daily Mail called me a Pratt when I wrote this book here. Actually, I'm very proud of being called a Pratt by the Daily Mail now I think about it. Lisa Jardine, one of those historians who I'd always held and put up there on the Pantheon of Greats. This is what she wrote about this book, Mercator. A gripping and densely informative biography, not just a fascinating investigation of one man's mathematical ingenuity. The race among the early cartographers to produce the finest, most precise, most usable graphic form for the maps charting the world turns out to be one of heart-stopping excitement, suspense, triumph, and tragedy. Well, hearing that from somebody who I'd never have dared speak to when I started working on the Mercator book made the entire project worthwhile. As you probably detected by now, I, like Mercator, had quite a lot to prove from working on that book. Thank you. So I think we've got a little time.